Scott McClellan is joining us now for our All Things Political segment. He is the author of What Happened Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception. He was the White House press secretary from 2003 to 2006, served as the principal deputy White House press secretary and as traveling press secretary for the Bush-Cheney 2000 campaign. He was also deputy communications director in the Texas governor's office, a top legislative aide and campaign manager for three successful statewide campaigns. He was born in Austin. His mother was mayor, a three-term Democratic mayor of Austin. So we'll find out how he became a Republican. His grandfather was a legendary dean who led the law school of the University of Texas. And he says that he is extremely familiar with the University of Texas Tower, the main building in the center of campus, with words that form the Gospel of John carved in stone at its south entrance. Ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. Scott says it's not been until the last few years that he's come to truly appreciate that particular message. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Scott McClellan as well. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to send an email, then you could do that at talk@wpr.org. Scott McClellan, hello. Thank you.
Good morning, Kathleen. Thanks for having me on today.
Our pleasure. So your mom's a Democrat, mayor of Austin for all these years. How did you switch?
Well, actually, it's an interesting story, and I try to give readers my perspective that I'm coming from, and part of that goes back to my family history and my upbringing. When I was 4 years old, my mother was elected to the Austin School Board, so I literally was born into the political world. By the time I was in third grade, this is the late 1970s, 1977, I guess, she was first elected to be mayor of Austin. She served three terms in that capacity. Now, in Texas, as opposed to some other states, local elections are nonpartisan, meaning you don't run on a party affiliation. But she was a Democrat at the time. I did grow up in a moderate to conservative Democratic household. And she switched parties in the mid-1980s. And I switched parties along with her right before I became of voting age. But you know, my family history, you mentioned my grandfather. My grandfather, W. Page Keaton, taught at the School of Law at the University of Texas most of his life, and he was dean of the law school for about 25 years and really took it to its national rise to prominence. And he instilled in us the importance of public service, the importance of speaking up. He used to say that it's not the dollars you make, it's the difference you make. And those are things that kind of have always stuck with me. And in many ways, I look at this book as almost a return to some of my family roots.
Interesting. I was interested in the chapters that dealt with your grandfather and your mother being very, very key, and you as well, to desegregation efforts in schools and universities.
That's right. My grandfather actually took it. He had been the I believe the assistant dean at the University of Texas School of Law in the late 40s, and took a brief leave of absence to accept the deanship at the University of Oklahoma School of Law, and he was played a role in helping to integrate the University of Oklahoma School of Law when the law had been that there should be separate but equal facilities. My granddad was called to testify, and he said there is no such thing as separate but equal, that it's inherently unequal when you have separate facilities like that. And the lawyer in that case who called him to testify was one Thurgood Marshall. And shortly after that, about 2 years later, I think my granddad returned to the University of Texas School of Law, and Heman Sweat case had been working its way through. Now, it had already been decided, but my granddad was the one who actually implemented the decision in that case to integrate the University of Texas School of Law, and he was someone who spoke very forcefully up on those issues.
Interesting. You talk about the truth, and you say that you don't claim a monopoly on truth, but after wrestling with your experiences in the White House over the past several months, you have come much closer to your truth than ever before. Tell me about that wrestling experience with the truth and how you go through your head and your heart to come up with your truth.
Sure. It's a long process. I think it's important for listeners to understand that when I went to work for then Governor Bush back in Texas, I was a young, idealistic political person who really admired the then Governor Bush for working across the aisle in Texas and being a strong bipartisan leader who had approval ratings well into the 70s. And I thought that, you know, he might be able to bring that same kind of bipartisan leadership to Washington. It turned out that that was far from the case, as he's become one of the most controversial and polarizing presidents, certainly in modern history. And after I left the White House, I had become disillusioned towards the end of my time at the White House. I wanted to, you know, take some time and look back and look at why that had happened. Why had he become such a polarizing and controversial figure? Why did things go so badly off course? And that was really the focus of the narrative of the book. And so as I started the writing process, it was just about a year ago, I started reflecting. I started doing my own research. I took off my press secretary hat. When you're press secretary, obviously you speak for the president and his decisions and his policies. You're not speaking for yourself. This was a time for me to kind of come to grips with reality from my own perspective about how things went so badly off course. And I put a lot of thought and research into the book as I went back and looked at events and some of the defining moments, both for me and for the presidency itself, and how things got to where they were today. And that's when I started looking at the permanent campaign culture in Washington, D.C., and how destructive that can become when it's embraced excessively, as we did, and particularly when it's transferred into the war-making process, which I think contributed greatly to the president's credibility being so low today.
Mm-hmm. The episode you write that became the jumping-off point for this book was the scandal over the leaking of classified national security information, the Valerie Plame affair. Would you please elaborate?
Sure. That was probably the most defining moment for my time at the podium. Shortly after I became press secretary, the actual disclosure of her identity, Valerie Plame's identity, occurred before I was White House press secretary. I'd been the deputy press secretary at the time. But when I came in, it's when the controversy started to brew over the president's words in the State of the Union about Iraq seeking uranium from Niger. And then a few months later, just about 3 months into my tenure, an investigation was formally launched by the Justice Department looking into who had actually disclosed Valerie Plame's identity publicly. She was a covert CIA operative and the wife of Joe Wilson, the ambassador who was criticizing us for the inclusion of the uranium claim in the State of the Union address. I went out and publicly said that Karl Rove and Scooter Libby had assured me that they were not involved in the disclosure or revealing of her identity. I made that statement based on direct conversations with Karl Rove and Scooter Libby. Both unequivocally assured me they were not involved. And it turned out just about 2 years later, 2 years into my time as press secretary, that both of them actually had been talking to reporters about her identity prior to it being publicly revealed by the conservative commentator and columnist Robert Novak. So what I had said was false. I had unknowingly passed that along. I believe the assurances I had received, and it really undermined my credibility at the podium. White House reporters knew me very well, and they actually were some of my strongest defenders during that time, saying that, you know, he's a straight shooter, my credibility is unquestioned. The fact that I couldn't defend myself, the White House counsel's office said, you know, we're not going to comment on this. It's an ongoing legal proceeding. So I couldn't defend myself. And it made it extremely more difficult for me to continue at the podium over the remaining 8, 9, 10 months that I was White House press secretary.
You say that you believed right off the bat in George Bush's leadership and agenda for America. I had confidence in his authenticity, integrity, and judgment. Did you have the same kind of feel for Rove and for Libby, or did you, because, you know, we have gut instincts about people. Did you feel that you were being talked to in a straight fashion by them all along or not?
Well, I did over the Plame episode. I specifically asked, were you, both of them, I asked the same question, were you involved in this in any way, the leaking of Valerie Plame's identity in any way? And both told me no. Scooter Libby told me no, absolutely not. Carl told me no. He said he couldn't have done it. He didn't even know about his wife at the time. So I did take them at the word. Now, at the same time, when I was at the podium, I did phrase it. They assured me they were not involved in this. That, I guess, leaves you a little bit of protection as a spokesman, something to fall back on, because you can't know with absolute certainty. But they were colleagues of mine. Carl Rove, of course, a fellow Texan who had come to Washington at the same time I had with the president. Scooter, I didn't know as well, but he was someone that I did participate in meetings with and did not visit with at length, in any personal way, really. It was more a professional relationship, but I did take them at their word. And in the book, I actually talk about how I felt like I shouldn't have put myself in that position in the first place. So I do hold myself responsible for putting myself in that position. Looking back and with more experience, I probably would have never gotten into that question in the first place.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, all of this leads to war. And you say, what I do know is that war should only be waged when necessary. And the Iraq War was not necessary.
That's right. From a moral standpoint, I am someone who believes that unless war is absolutely necessary, we shouldn't be going to war. Now, during the build-up to the war, I was the deputy White House press secretary. Most of my focus was on domestic issues. There were other deputy press secretaries and a chief spokesman for the National Security Council who served as a deputy as well, that focused elsewhere. But I did fill in for my predecessor because I was the principal deputy press secretary. So I filled in for my predecessor from time to time, and did participate some in advocating the president's views and positions. And I think, like, there were a lot of Americans at the time were caught up in that post 9/11 environment. I was like them. I was wondering, it seems like we're moving into this awfully fast. Is this necessary? But I gave the president and his foreign policy team the benefit of the doubt. They had the access to the full intelligence. They were seeing what the intelligence was showing, and I went along with it. It's not till I had time to look back and reflect on this that I realized fully that this was not a necessary war, that this was not as serious and urgent threat as it was portrayed by the administration. And I think the Senate Intelligence Committee this past Friday released its report about how the intelligence was used, and it's remarkably similar to what I say in my book about how the intelligence, while it could have, much of it can be substantiated, the way it was packaged and the way it was made to sound more certain than it was, the way caveats were dropped and contradictory intelligence was ignored in the making the public case, made the threat seem much more serious than it was. And that lack of openness and candor, I really think, hurt the president in the aftermath of the invasion. And I talk about that as well in the book.
Yeah. You talk about him. Let's spend some time on his personality. You say that he remains the same. Bush remains the same. Self-confident, quick-witted, down-to-earth, and stubborn. Bush very much the man he always was, though not quite the leader that you once imagined him to be. Why did he become the leader that you not become the leader that
right.
you once imagined?
Well, I think that's one of the hardest things to do, as you asked at the top, when you're going through the process of writing a book and trying to be as candid as possible about things, is separating your personal affection for the leader from his policies and from his governance. And that's what you have to be able to do in order to get to an honest account of your experience and what you learned from it. And when I say that he's not quite the leader I thought he was, I'm referring specifically to how he was as governor of Texas when he was committed to bipartisan deliberation and compromise. But I think when he came to Washington, he quickly changed, and some of this is what he learned from his father, from his father's time in office, that Washington tends to be focused too much on who can shape and manipulate the media narrative to its side's advantage, and that it's a game, it's a game of who has power and who has influence, and that's what the battle is, versus the more important priority of bipartisan deliberation and compromise, working to get things done, working to solve problems and build consensus. That becomes a distant second. And the president is someone who quickly moved away from that. He was sincere to an extent that he wanted to change the tone and change the way Washington works, much as we hear both candidates talking about today. But I think at the same time, he recognized that the Washington game has come to be played a certain way, and he wasn't going to try too hard to change that as he had said he would during the 2000 campaign.
Mm-hmm. Do you think he's smart?
I do. I think he is, but at the same time, I talk about how he is someone who is an instinctive leader. I question, I think it's fair to question some of his judgments because of his instincts and his lack of, that there's a certain lack of intellectual curiosity on his part. But he's plenty smart enough to be president. I don't think he would have been elected in the first place if he wasn't. But he's not someone to sit around and debate all the various policy options for an extended period of time. He's someone who tends to. He came into office and he said, "I've got clear principles. I know what I believe," and he tends to make decisions instinctively from his gut rather quickly, and then say, "Okay, how do we go about implementing this?" And he expects everyone, once that decision is made, to march in lockstep with that decision, not to question the decision. He doesn't spend time reflecting once that decision is made. And to some extent, you can appreciate that being president, but reflection is important in a president as well. And they should be willing to spend some time reflecting on their decisions, particularly the most controversial ones.
Well, welcome to Phone Calls. Scott McClellan is our guest this half hour. His book is What Happened Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception. All four lines are filled. Just keep the number in mind, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Emails you can send at talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, we'll be speaking with Richard Engel, NBC News Middle East correspondent, about his experiences in Iraq. War Journal is the name of his book, My 5 Years in Iraq. Scott McClellan is with us now. What happened inside the Bush White House and Washington's culture of deception? We start our phone calls with Ed from West Dallas. Hi, Ed.
Well, good morning. Mea culpa, mea culpa, mea maxima culpa. I certainly think that confession is not only good for your soul, Mr. McClellan, but for the soul of the nation. And I think you have written an excellent book. Anyone that can provoke Father John McLaughlin and Monica Crowley to apoplexy this past weekend certainly is doing something right. But we knew about George Bush way back in the 90s. Karl Rove ran a vicious campaign against Ann Richards in the mid-1990s. I'm sure you're familiar with the video that the state AFL-CIO in Texas put out, Texas Trail, firsthand in Bushland, during the 2000 campaign. And the bipartisanship that you speak of is really a chimera. It never existed with Bush. And my only other comment is, thank you for the book, but do you owe an apology to the Dixie Chicks and Michael Moore and those of us that stood up against this war and had our patriotism questioned?
Thank you for the question, Ed. In terms of the bipartisanship in Texas, it was real. As governor, the president worked very closely with Lieutenant Governor Bob Bullock, a Democrat, and the Speaker of the House, Pete Laney, for his first 4 years. Then the lieutenant governor became a Republican for the last 2 years of his term as the previous lieutenant governor decided to step down from politics. But the bipartisanship was there, I think, and I think that's evident by the fact that more than 70% of the Texans approved of the job that then-Governor Bush was doing. And it certainly was something that appealed to me in our very first conversation that we had before then Governor Bush hired me. I actually brought that up and talked to him about how people of my generation and younger generations in particular are ready to move beyond all the excessive partisanship that exists nationally. And he did that. Governor Bush did that in Texas. In terms of the second part of your question, I think you were asking about an apology. I think what I've done is something even more important, which is give an open and honest account of my experiences and what I learned from them so that hopefully we can move beyond this destructive culture in Washington, D.C. that is too focused on this permanent campaign mentality and that has led to the partisan warfare or exacerbated the partisan warfare of the past 7.5, 8 years. It's something now that existed before us, but the president pledged to do something to change that, and instead he made it worse by not being open and candor. The first thing a president has to do more than anything else is embrace a high level of openness and candor with the American people. Otherwise, you're going to run into problems. We saw that with Iraq. It wasn't just the decision. When I went back and looked and spent time thinking through this book and why things went off course, it wasn't just the decision to go into Iraq, which arguably some could make the case was justified separate and apart from the chief rationale that we advocated, which now turned out to be overstated and turned out to be false in many ways. I think it's important that we look at some of the ideas for moving beyond this bitter, excessive partisan environment that exists. And that's what I do at the end of the book as well, is talk about some ideas for doing that. And I think that's one of the most important ways that I can contribute something back by continuing to speak up and make a positive difference that might just lead to some small changes here in Washington.
Mm-hmm. You write at one point in the book, and this is probably a part of the president that we haven't seen, Scott. It was a visit to the Walter Reed Medical Center. The president meets a woman, her 7-year-old son. Yes. They're with a husband and father. A brain injury so severe, he's not aware of where he is. Bush hugs the mother and tells the boy his dad is a very brave man, whispers in the man's ear, God bless you. And then, and you're with him, as he leaves the room, he wipes away a tear. You say, I could see the doubt in his eyes and the vivid realization of the irrevocable consequences of his decision. We don't hear that much about him, and I have two questions. Were there more moments than that when he was thinking about the consequences of his decision? And what about you? What were you thinking about this war during that time?
Those are particularly moving moments, as you just mentioned. I spent a number of times, what I would do when the president would visit the wounded, I would tag along with him. And sometimes Mrs. Bush would be with him, whether it was in Washington at Walter Reed or Bethesda Navy Medical Center or elsewhere on the road. And also when he would visit the families of the fallen. Those were moments when the president could not step away. He had to reflect. He had to look back because the consequences of the decision that he knew he made were right there staring him in the eye. And that particular moment I mentioned was one of the most moving moments because the gentleman, as I said, did not even seem to know where he was. Mm. And when the president's walking out of there, I could see how moved he was by it. You can't help but reflect. Now, the other side of this was when he would visit with the families of the fallen. And more often than not, a mother or father would look him in the eye and say, you make sure you finish the job. You make sure my son or my daughter or whoever did not die in vain. And that almost reinforced in the president's mind this sense that he had to continue to stay the course, to continue to push this through and make sure that we succeeded. It was reinforcing to his own thoughts in many ways, and I think in some ways blinded him to the importance of trying to forge a consensus, bipartisan consensus way forward, such as the Iraq Study Group put forward back in 2006, and that the White House should have fully embraced but chose not to, and that might help be a way to bring this war to an end sooner rather than later, because our troops have succeeded in every way possible. They've done more than they've been called on to do. And I'm not one for rapid withdrawal, but we do need to figure out an end game here and get our troops, pull them back out of the combat operations.
Jeff is next from Milwaukee, and we're running short on time. Jeff, hi. Are you there, Jeff? Oh, sorry, Jeff. Let's go to Ann from Madison. Hi, Ann. Hello, Ann. Well, I don't know what's going on here, so I'll just ask the question. So are you signing up with Obama or McCain?
Well, I actually haven't decided.
Really?
I know this may surprise some of my former colleagues, but I've been so focused on the book, I also want to take time and really think this through. Now, interestingly enough, both Senator McCain and Senator Obama have talked about some of the very themes in my book. Of course, Senator Obama, we've seen, has been running on changing the way Washington works and improving the way Washington governs from the outset, and being a someone who can unify the nation around an agenda. It's not a message that's unsimilar from what the president ran on in 2000 when he said he's a uniter, not a divider. Senator McCain recently has been talking about ending the permanent campaign. I don't think you can end it, because the political advisors are always going to have strong influence in the White House, whether they're on the inside or outside, and there will always be a large political operation. But you've got to minimize the excesses. You've got to bring in some counterweights to that political influence and get the focus back on working with leaders in Congress to try to forge consensus, rather than spending all your time out trying to just manipulate the narrative to your advantage and pressure win over public opinion in order to pressure Congress to do what you want. And you know, hopefully that can happen. But I'm going to think through this. I do respect Senator McCain in many ways and his history, but I'm also intrigued by what Senator Obama has to say and his message.
Thank you, Scott, so much for being with us and for writing the book. Thanks.
Thank you, Kathleen. Enjoyed it.
Scott McClellan, his book is What Happened Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception. It, of course, has just been published by Public Affairs. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to John Anderson for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. We have news coming up, and we'll return with more Monday Conversation on the Ideas Network.